be Saturday?
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Hello, hello, hello. Smooth introduction as always to
indeed.
Film Fight Club.
Good Lord, indeed, show us the way.
Where did that come from, Virat? I never thought of you as a man of God.
I don't know. I'm just thinking about the house that Jack built.
Yes, that is indeed a film about the Word of God.
Is it, though? I'm not quite sure, but yeah, hopefully not. Yeah, it is about something, a lot of things, and about nothing in particular.
Let's hope that we can shed more light in a moment. This is Chris Evans. I'm joined by Virat Nehru. We've kicked Chanel Tarabe out of the club. No,
it
that's
was
actually
a mutual
not true. She's actually
out.
Very busy doing important stuff while we sit here crapping on about film. Thanks for joining us.
She's
on
a PhD person, right? So she's actually important.
She's actually doing work on aggression. So yay, Chanel. So this week we'll be talking about The House That Jack Built and Everybody Knows, two divisive films from World Cinema Auteurs, and we'll also have Virat Nehru on Captain Marvel and Hotel Mumbai, two films that I haven't gotten around to seeing, but I know that Virat has some strong opinions about.
Yeah, strong opinions. More on Hotel Mumbai, less on Captain Marvel, but still, yeah, strong opinions nonetheless.
Strong opinions, I think, are going to be needed tonight, because I'm not feeling much passion for any of what we're about to discuss.
It's so, okay. Actually, after this week, I can make up for that for some weird reason. I don't know. It was just maybe it's the films that I'm going to talk about, which kind of incited some very polarizing opinions in me. You know, male opinions come to the fore.
Fair enough. So, if The House That Jack Built is the latest horror provocation from Lars von Trier, if you would believe the media narrative about the film, it's actually a pretty typical Lars von Trier effort, I would say, and not particularly shocking by his standards.
Yeah.
It's about a serial killer speaking, played by Matt Dillon, reprising his role as the fake architect from There's Something About Mary, who's also accused of being a serial killer.
Yeah. Actually, didn't think about that.
He is recounting the story of five of his greatest murders, which he describes as being works of art, to a, for most of the film, unseen accomplice who is challenging him as he talks through his murders. What did we think?
Yeah. I mean, in one sense, how do we engage with Lars von Trier in a sense where he's kind of a despicable human being in his opinions and stuff, and his art itself...
Well, he's leaning into this persona of being a really despicable human being with this film especially. Like, this is a film, I would say, about the idea of Lars von Trier as despicable human being. If we think that Lars von Trier is talking in metaphor about himself through this serial killer protagonist, and the film lends you to perhaps interpreting it that way, because we see at some point where Matt Dillon's killer is talking about his murders and relating them to art, we see clips of Lars von Trier's own films.
Yeah.
And yeah, this film received a lot of controversy because a lot of the murders that are depicted are incredibly violent towards women. It's almost all the stories he tells are about murdering women. And a lot of people could relate that to the particularly savage treatment of female characters in Lars von Trier's films. But if this is how Lars von Trier sees himself, I think he's being quite hard on himself, because I think in his best works, he isn't just mining human misery because he feeds on it. I think that he gets at some kind of humanistic empathy and suffering. That
he does. The problem
films like Breaking the Waves or Dancer in the Dark, right? But
yeah.
If this is how he sees himself, this is a very bleak, depressing perspective.
I don't know. I don't think Lars von Trier gives himself that much credit. And I think part of this is now he's entering this kind of late Godard period where he feels like he doesn't really, he's not beholden to anyone or anything. And he can make the kind of movies that he kind of always wanted to make, except that he's always been making the kind of movies he kind of wanted to make anyway.
I like that this is so free aesthetically.
Yeah.
In many ways, it's more of a video essay than it is a conventional narrative film.
A lot of parallels to The Image Book, actually.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of talk about art in history, which just is conveyed through still images on a black background. Yeah. And voiceover, making connections
and actually,
between...
It was funnier than I thought it would be. Actually, and humor is something which I hadn't counted upon. Even though it's probably thematically weaker than a lot of his other films, I thought the humor is something which is unexpected. Because not just in a black humor kind of way, it's genuinely funny.
I think there's an interesting balance that Lars von Trier strikes here, because... there is comedy in some of the situations that the killer finds himself in, and also in the way that Bruno Ganz, playing Verge, whose identity becomes clear over the course of the film, just pokes holes in his line of reasoning and shoots him down. But at the same time, I think taking that kind of cynical, detached, a comedic approach to a serial killer could have resulted in a film that's overly glamorizing or making light of the murders. But what's very clear here is that I don't think von Trier sees any kind of fun or joy in the killings here. It's pretty much bleak. It's not fun to watch at all.
Not at all. But at the same time, so, I kind of feel, what is the point, beyond... It's not a psychological study of sociopaths or psychopaths in that sense.
I think it is exploring psychopathy. Like I think Matt Dillon gave a really good performance in the way that he brought about that he shows a kind of detached Machiavellian perspective. Like he sort of has a dry humor in the way that he goes about normal human interactions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think this film is pretty accurate to the way that psychopaths perceive the world. But Lars von Trier isn't really that interested in mining any of the normal plot beats that we see in psychopath films. It's entirely about just portraying five incidents of murder. Yeah. And
it's very disconnected in that sense. It's actually quite anti-narrative. It's trying not to tell you a cohesive story. And just
that's
like,
true.
It's actually... kind of making fun of the audience as well for expecting a kind of neatly timed together kind of narrative, especially the ending. The ending is, without giving anything away, probably the best or
I think
the
it's
most
the best
interesting
part of
the film.
The part about the ending is that that von Trier has maintained a detached perspective for so long, but then at the end he does not spare us from moral judgment.
Yeah.
And depicts that with a surprising amount of sincerity.
Yeah.
But maybe true despair is what Lars von Trier believes in most.
I know. Especially, I think it's interesting, the thing about especially how red, and I was just like harking back to Suspiria and that kind of...
It's good to see Lars von Trier break out, because for a long time his films have been just kind of like shaky cam and drab grey landscapes. It was nice to see him stretch out aesthetically towards the end of this. On the subject of the aesthetic, his filmmaking in this is really fun and keeps the whole thing engaging, where it could easily have become extremely dry.
Yeah.
There's a mix, different kinds of media coming in, animations, the aforementioned kind of clip art, art history tours, found footage, clips from Lars von Trier's own films. The problem for me with these is that I don't think the points that the killer, Matt Dillon, Jack, is making in his conversations with Virgil that overlaid over these mixed media sequences are actually that interesting or intellectually engaging. It sounded like pretentious. It sounded pretentious because there's a lot of empty grasping towards intellectual concepts about what is the nature of art. Is there art in destruction and death? Is there, can you portray, view those from a perspective of beauty or do moral, does morality have to be at the forefront of art? And von Trier is linking these things to things like the art that came out of the Nazi regime. But that is a...
It's very philosophy 101.
Yeah, I was going to say that's something basic that aesthetic philosophy delves into in, really interesting ways. There's a lot of room to be mined there. But I didn't find that format worked as well here as it did in Nymphomaniac. Nymphomaniac was also about a protagonist debating moral points.
But I think with Nymphomaniac, it worked better because it was actually a character study. What actually kind of works against this film is that we don't know anything about the character.
I did actually think that the way that Jack was portrayed was interesting. Just as you said, it is anti-narrative, but I do think that von Trier gets to some of the realities of how psychopaths interact with people and the way that this guy...
I think that's more
the hubris. What this film is really about is hubris. And the idea of artistic hubris overcoming everything to the point that artists lack empathy.
Yeah.
You know, to think that other people are beneath them because they can't see the grand ideas that are in their head. And von Trier is mocking that idea by attaching it to somebody
in a way.
Well, he perhaps feels himself as that, but he's attaching that idea to a psychopath, a person who is destructive to society and offers nothing, but has still come to believe in himself.
Is that also a return
to our Vox Lux discussion about whether artists actually give anything to the world?
But also, is that also because he sees himself like that? That despite the fact that he sees himself as a great artist, that he thinks because there is a lot of self-referential kind of, you know, aggrandizing moments in the film where he thinks that, you know, look at me, I'm such a great artist, and yet I have some kind of psychopathic tendencies that I can't really admonish myself from.
And that maybe people give him praise for creating depictions of human suffering, but is he just getting off on it? Am I just a serial killer, metaphorically?
Or just the fact that he likes the hate that he gets, because I think that's part of the...
That's part of the character of Jack in this film. He thrives off the fame.
Yeah.
David Bowie's fame keeps repeating throughout the film.
Oh,
and
God.
He's... Yeah.
That was so basic, by the way.
It is.
Like, some of this film is so, like, kindergarten level basic that I've just, like, you don't need to hammer the point home. And I think that's what really annoyed me, because I was like, the visually, this film is more interesting than anything which, like...
Visually, it is interesting. The mix of some, you know, unexpected zooms, the fast, choppy camera movement, and the mixed media collages. Yeah, it's most interesting to me formally. I think von Trier is grasping towards a lot of interesting ideas. I just think they needed a lot more expanse, because as a video essay, it actually says way less than the image book, and it's twice the length of that.
Yeah.
It really, as you say, it is Philosophy 101, but Philosophy 101 takes you in greater depth even into some of these most basic ideas.
Because a lot of themes
philosophy.
Repeat as well, and a lot of these conversations are quite repetitive. They come back to the same thing again and again and again, and I'm like, I get it. Like, you know, you're just two dudes talking about stuff in the end.
Welcome to Film Fight Club.
Look at the very self-awareness.
You know, in keeping with
The studio that we built, which is TOCR.
I do like that it pokes holes in... you know, the audience that wants to see death and suffering on screen for the sake of it, and that it does not glamorize the idea of a serial killer.
Do you think the people that walked out kind of missed that point?
I think so. I think I can understand being upset by it, because some of the things depicted in this are extremely cruel. But I think it's clear that... I think people want their art to be very simple and the messages handed to them on a plate. And in this, von Trier listens to the serial killer and is able to empathize with him for a moment, even if the film is ultimately on the side of Virgil in denouncing Jack. And that should be very clear to anyone who sticks around with the whole film. But I think people possibly lack the media literacy to be able to extend themselves to maybe try to put themselves in the serial killer's shoes.
Or just
that doesn't mean that you're in any way... approving
complicit,
of these actions,
yeah.
complicit. It's almost like a thought experiment to try to understand where this person is coming from. But the film, I think, is not amoral by any means.
Especially like in today's times, where I feel art has become a battleground for social justice.
That's right. It was not the right time for this film to be released, because
maybe the perfect time. You know, where I think things have become so, like, it has to be morally upright.
It has to be
moral.
It has
art.
To be pure.
Yeah.
I do think that morality in art is important, but not to the extent that we can't allow something like this into the world.
Yeah.
Because I think he's grasping, this is in service of ideas.
Yeah.
This isn't just a glamorization of serial killer or wallowing in senseless violence or a misogyny for the sake of misogyny.
I know, but
I think
towards the end,
I think it becomes clear that this is an unreliable narrator, and this is a story about the way that a lot of misogynist men perceive the world and perceive women.
Well, a lot of people might say that, you know, films that are in service of ideas is exactly the kind of defense that people who, you know, like amoral things would give, because it's just because it's a surface of ideas, it needs to exist, which is kind of the very kind of PSC and like conservative political set of ideas that seem to play off this and how the world sees itself, which is interesting. Yeah.
We could get into some deeper ideas here than the house that Jack built ever finds the time to
explore.
Actually,
that is true, yeah. But so, it's still 2.5 hours long. It is way too long.
It's way too long. Yeah. But I found just the craft to be engaging enough. If anything, it's not extreme enough in some of the imagery and not rich enough in some of the ideas. So
yeah, it's playing in limited release across cinemas. And yeah, go watch it or not, actually. We can't...
Well, actually, Riley Keough hilariously said that on her some social media account. She was like, go watch this or don't, I guess.
Yeah, because how do we recommend this? I mean...
It's all right. If you're interested in Lars von Trier films, yeah. I think this is actually... It's not one of the weaker ones in his career, so yeah. Pretty typical Lars von Trier film.
I'll basically give a shout out to one of my friends who did a PhD on Lars von Trier films, so he might be interested to see it. So if he already hasn't, so yeah,
I'm sure he would have.
So one person go see and watch it, and everyone else, you know, on the fence.
So for the film that many, many more people have probably already seen, or definitely have already seen, than will ever watch The House That Jack Built. That Virat Nehru saw, but I didn't, as part of my ongoing protest against Marvel Studios. Marvel.
Well, yeah, this film
that
was
that was ironic, by the way. Yeah. I'm just not interested enough to watch it. I don't, whatever. Here's Virat on Captain Marvel.
Yeah, Captain Marvel. God, how? Where do we begin? It's the last kind of tie-in before we get to the end game, as they call it, okay. you know, whatever, the Avengers and things.
So so she's called Captain Marvel, and we're all just accepting that. It's like going to the movies to see, like, you know, John Disney saves the world. Like,
yeah, well,
remember Captain Nintendo in the 80s? It's like we've cycled back to 80s level of merchandise, corporate-driven characters.
It is kind of sad and destructive, because the American military has co-opted Captain Marvel as a symbol of, you know, strength in the U.S. military, and it's very militarization, you know, agenda, except the film is very anti-war. So it's the kind of threats that play off each other. It's very interesting because all the merchandise, all the kind of corporate marketing around it is very pro-military. You know, it's
right.
Go Captain Marvel, smash these people.
Very Michael Bay.
Yeah, very Michael Bay, except the film is not that. The film is actually a very anti-war.
What is the film?
What is
it's
the film?
It's directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, who made Half Nelson, which that's the only thing by them I saw. So this seems like a massive change of pace.
Well,
is it well-directed?
It is and it's not. It's still telling an origin story, and you know it's not as good as Wonder Woman. So I mean, that's the benchmark we have in terms of female-led superhero movies, because there's only been one. So it's still not as good as that. But also, it sort of tells you the most interesting part about this film is how Nick Fury, aka Samuel L. Jackson, aka the one who, you know, said the F-bomb at the Oscars, got the eye patch. You know, the biggest mystery in the Marvel universe is solved in this movie.
Why is it that whenever there's an interesting character detail that makes someone cool and mysterious, there's a film that comes along that, like Solo or whatever, that tries to explain it all away?
Pretty much. And the biggest, the best, most interesting character development or dynamic is between Nick Fury and a cat.
Right.
That
so
says the most about this film, I can sort of give away. Because Brie Larson is amazing. A lot of this film is resting upon 80s, 90s nostalgia. So a lot of that kind of music.
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
Wearing...
This is set in the 90s, right? Early 90s? Yeah. Does that actually have any bearing on the plot?
Yeah, because she's kind of an alien and, you know, she's landing up on Earth. So, you know, she's discovering 90s nostalgia. So it's, once again, very Guardians of the Galaxy kind of ploy.
Right.
To use a lot of the nostalgia, mine that stuff.
It's been 5 years since Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah. You know, the 80s kids are switching over to becoming the 90s kids who are the biggest.
So the Marvel template is like pretty, like you can just, you know, you just know it, unfortunately.
Any interesting characters or plot threads, or is this just completely
these two are it. I mean, Nick Fury and the cat are the two most interesting things about this film.
Is Captain Marvel
Jude Law is there
hero?
As well. Jude Law is a mentor figure for Captain Marvel.
Just like in Vox Lux.
Actually, Jude Law is playing Jude Law again, actually. That's the same. He's playing himself. So, you know, it's that. And, you know, there's some interesting things about how Captain Marvel
really
gets the very kind of, you know, blaster things of fists and whatever.
Is that interesting?
Well, there's less CGI... you know, third act fighting.
So there's not like a giant fight against...
Yeah, actually, this is not a fight-intensive movie.
That's actually surprising.
which a lot of people hated because they were expecting more like kick butt, women should kick butt kind of thing, and this is not that kind of movie.
But
there are some action sequences, but they're not that interesting.
That's one of the few things that makes me in any way curious to see this. I'm so sick of the CGI overload in the third act of every Marvel film.
It is. It's still there, but it's definitely less than. And this is not an action-intensive movie.
Fair enough.
It's more like a dialogue and like, you know, setting the context kind of movie, which kind of threw off people because, you know, it's the last movie before Endgame, which is supposed to tie everything together. So people were expecting more like, you know, action and like, how will things get resolved? But it's nothing about that. You can actually skip this movie and you still be like, okay.
It won't matter too much.
All it sets up is there's a superhuman character, which is as powerful as Thor.
Marvel is smart.
Added into the actual.
So now
Avengers
there's another strong one.
Yeah, basically.
It's like how Doctor Strange. All you need to do is he does the cool trippy moves. Like you don't need to watch the first Doctor Strange movie.
Yeah. But like if I were to give this film credit, Brie Larson does carry off the role pretty well. I mean, she's fantastic in a very limited scope that she's been given.
Yeah,
she's expected to not emote and look confused a lot, and she does it very well. And, you know, you still kind of get why she's being confused because she's doing the fish out of water thing and it gets repetitive after a while, but still it's good.
All right. So Captain Marvel, go see it, I guess.
2.5, yeah, you know, depending on how you turn.
So I guess don't go see it.
see it or
man,
or
I need
don't.
To retire this just overly cynical persona, right? It's like when you're reviewing films and you just have to talk about Marvel movies.
Go see it for Nick Fury and the cat. Yeah.
Oh, God. Anyway. Everybody Knows is the new film from Asghar Farhadi. It's about a family reunion that when a wedding happens that leads to a daughter getting kidnapped and the family all turning on each other. It's set in Spain, unlike Farhadi's other films, except for The Past, which was set in France.
But it's not in Spanish. Dun, dun, dun.
Everybody Knows?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Oh, wait, it is in Spanish.
Yeah, yeah.
A bit.
It's in Spanish.
Everybody knows that.
Everybody knows. So, yeah. Asghar Farhadi is a very solid filmmaker, I think. But he's getting to the point that he's repeating a lot of his tropes in every film. And this is actually probably the least interesting of his narratives that I've seen in a while. I really liked The Salesman without loving it. But already there, you could see the plot mechanics starting to get creaky. Yeah. It's always the same kind of Chekhovian twists. And
A small kind of family secret comes out, which like snowballs into a bigger thing, bigger revelations.
That's right. But the problem here for me is the revelations are so predictable and so been there, done that for these kinds of family dynamic type films.
Also, like they're not that life-changing. Like, you know, it's not that big a revelation. It's just like, oh, okay, then that happened.
The biggest revelation is a fairly big one, but it's one that you've seen in so many films of this type before.
Yeah.
And in the better narratives he's done, like about Ellie or A Separation, you really feel the pain of characters within their social context having to deal with culturally shocking bombs. And I wonder if Farhadi, having less familiarity with a European social context, means that he's not able to create, you know, that kind of narrative here. This is far more universal in the way that it's pitched. It's less about culturally specific things. But even for me, without that much knowledge on Iranian culture, you can feel the tension of the cultural specificities, the wounds that are being opened up in some of his previous films. And I didn't really so much feel it here. The other problem for me is that this feels really and this has always been a little bit of a weakness for him, but particularly this film feels incredibly plot driven to the extent that I don't feel much of the humanity of these characters. They're all incredible actors. Casting's great, and Penelope Cruz gives it her all with, you know,
she does. She can cry like no other.
That's
She's a really good crier. I mean, that's weird, but like she is.
She is. She's crying constantly in this film, and she makes it.
Like,
she sells
really
it.
Believable. Like, because like there's different types of crying, and I just couldn't understand the nuances of like crying until I was like, oh my God, she's crying, but like this is a different kind of cry. Like,
yeah, I'm just a cry. That's right. She gives you all the different flavors of Penelope Cruz flying, and Javier Bardem does a lot of great exhaustion and inner pain, but the script doesn't give him much to work with. He does a good, he does.
He's a nice brooding protagonist. That's right. That's about it.
He does the best with what he's been given, which is not that much. And I think for this kind of thing to really work, you have to be in there within the characters' lives. I think part of the problem is that this is so stacked with incidents that rather than just letting the fullness of the revelations play out, it's like a big fight about this, then a big fight about this other thing.
And not all the characters are kind of developed. Yeah, yeah. Because like apart from Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem, the rest of the family and the cast, they're not given that much to do.
No, they're not. And the few other characters that end up having something to do at the climax, the turn that the film goes to is so predictable. And again, like The House That Jack Built, this is a really long film. It's 2 hours and 15 minutes, and it could easily have been 80 or 90 minutes. Yeah. You don't, like, it's sort of the school of thinking that more yelling equals higher drama. Is there anything else we want to say about...
No, I think everybody knows.
I will say that there is something nice about the Iranian director Farhadi filming Spain here, because there's some beautiful travelogue photography. He really enjoys clearly following motorbikes and cars and tractors around the countryside, and gives you some great sweeping shots. It's beautiful sunlight.
Kind of Spain that you usually see in
films. It's really like someone coming in with fresh eyes and giving you something different. So I loved that about the film. It looks great. I think Farhadi will do something good again. But
Iranian directors kind of find their footing pretty quickly.
Yeah, this is one of his lesser efforts. It's still a solid adult drama film in the time when we don't have too many of those in cinemas. So that's Everybody Knows, which is in cinemas now. Lastly, for the last 4 or 5 minutes of the program, we'll have Virat on Hotel Mumbai.
Oh my God. Ugh. Like it was really difficult for me to actually sit through this film, not only because it's going through terror attacks that happened in India a long time ago, but also because of what's happened in the Australian New Zealand context quite recently. And it was just kind of exacerbated the question of why do we need this film? You know, it's why do we need to recreate
this? Yeah, why now?
Yeah, why now? Or just,
is it
or just
like
why in
Paul
general?
Greengrass, like, let's recreate the horror type.
Yeah, it's trying to go for that idea that, you know, there is some kind of humanity in, you know, horrible situations. You know, humanity kind of pulls together and comes together, and unlikely people from different cultures can find some common ground in horrible situations. Except it's not about that. It's mostly trying to recreate, and it's set up as a stylized thriller, which is kind of the problem. It thinks it's more profound than it is. It's actually not. The problem this movie has is that it just... Vox Lux, actually, once again, is a good counterpoint to this. It's commercializing and mining trauma for, you know, white people's tears.
Yeah.
It's just that. It's literally that.
It's just, here is an event and we're going to make some money off
Unfortunately,
it.
Unfortunately, Netflix is
something
not going to...
Something that's close to everyone's heart.
Yeah, Netflix is not going to actually sell this in India because they're in a legal battle. And thankfully not. It's not going to release in India at all.
What's the battle over?
It's about releasing territories, and they're actually, you know, on shaky ground in that. So Netflix said, we're not going to do it. Which is a good thing, because there are a lot of factual inaccuracies, even though this film is supposed to be a fictional retelling.
Right.
There's such basic inaccuracies and incorrectness in how the events have unfolded that, you know, suddenly you're like, there are also terrorists singing a song, you know, while they're waiting in the hostages. And then suddenly I was just like, what kind of a movie am I watching? Like, what do you expect me to feel? Am I supposed to be horrified? And it's not going for any kind of profound meaning of what these people mean or why this event happened. And in the end, you kind of feel very cheapened, especially as someone who grew up in India and, you know, very kind of personally attached to these events. Often when these sort of things happen, you kind of want to, even though it's supposed to be somewhat of a homage to survivors, it just feels kind of annoying. But yeah.
Is this film largely just about the white characters' perspectives?
It is. It's basically the guests in the film who are basically foreign and white. It's from their perspective, and the staff are just there in service of the guests. So Dave Patel, even though he's playing one of the major protagonists, is just there to rescue white people.
So it's just another, as you say, sort of white people tier movies.
Yeah.
Like, why do the white characters have to be the protagonists of this story?
Exactly. Armie Hammer, who's one of the protagonists, who's one of the heroes, and the one character who doesn't survive, he didn't need to be in this movie. Well, you know, he's cute and handsome, but he dies. Boo-hoo. But, like, he had no point in this movie. You know, it's not about white people, but it's still...
But they've made it about white people?
Yeah, exactly, in a movie set in India.
Right.
So it's don't go watch this movie. It's bad.
Don't go see Hotel Mumbai. For those keeping score, maybe go see House That Jack Built. Maybe go see Everybody Knows.
Definitely don't see Hotel Mumbai.
We'll be back next week. Have a good night, everyone. Enjoy movies. Maybe watch some good ones. Good night.